So, one of the important and useful qualities, inner qualities that will hopefully develop as you do this practice is confidence. And that confidence can be in many things. It can be confidence in the practice of mindfulness. I often feel that when mindfulness, I do the best I can, but that at some point the practice becomes a gift. At some point something shifts and changes inside, and there's something of its own momentum in the practice, or there's something in which there's a shift within, where there's a whole different feeling of being, what it means to be connected, to be present, to be here. And when that happens, it's kind of a gift. And I've learned over the years to have a lot of confidence in just doing the practice. And I can't make the gift happen, but I can set the conditions for it. I just keep doing the practice, and at some point, I'm still surprised a little bit. Oh, there it is. It's possible to have confidence in yourself as a practitioner, as a person. And that confidence can be embodied. It's not just an idea, but it's how we carry ourselves, how we hold ourselves, how we breathe, how we use our eyes. Everything can have an easeful confidence when we're not pushed around by things or caught by things so easily. Maybe because we have the practice we can rely on, trust. And it's a very powerful thing to have this kind of growing confidence inside, growing sense of assurance inside, because as it grows, things begin to fall away, as opposed to things getting solved or things being fixed. And I think it's probably fair to say that for some of us who have grown up in the psychological wings of Western culture, the post-Freudian, Jungian, Maslowian, Perlillian, Fritz Perls, Western psychological world, there's a lot of self-preoccupation, a lot of turning in to understand our psychology, or if you're a parent, to analyze and care for the intricacies of what we think is our kids' inner psychological life. That some generations before, parents didn't think about this, but now there's a kind of amazing amount of focus on psychology and all that. And some of it is fantastic, really wonderful, important. But it can be overdone. And it can be that we think that everything has to be negotiated through our psychology, our inner life, and me, myself, and mine, and looking at all the intricacies of our feelings, emotions, our attitudes, our beliefs, our stories, all kinds of things. And some of what we encounter is, you know, things we don't want there. We want to somehow become free of our fears, our angers, our hurts, our resentments, our delusions, all kinds of things. We want to kind of figure out how to do it. And so we do one more workshop, one more book, one more something that's going to help us. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that sometimes I worry that it's kind of a labyrinth that some people go into. And they'll never come out of that labyrinth of self and self-help and all that. But confidence to kind of grow, I like the metaphor, I use the metaphor of a labyrinth, that with the practice, we can become bigger. We can become the elephant, in a sense, that can look over the walls of the labyrinth and feel at ease and knows the way out because they can see over it and see where to walk and where to go. Or to say it differently, with enough confidence that some of the things that are problems for us begin to fall away. They don't get solved. They just fall away. They're not that interesting anymore. They're not that We don't put them, they're not held at the center of who we are. And I think something like that has probably happened to most of you in some regard, I think all of you are old enough to have matured a bit and to recognize how you were when you were a teenager, how you were when you were maybe in the 20s or something. And you see that actually things that were you were preoccupied with and concerned with, you know, it isn't like you solved them or fixed them or some aha moment, but some of it you just slowly changed and developed and they kind of just fell away. Something slowly and you're no longer particularly interested in them, and then at some point you were just happy. Well, they were just like far in the background and not really a concern anymore. And you matured out of them and they fell away. And in that sense, mindfulness meditation, if you do it regularly, is a kind of premature aging, which is not good news. We don't advertise that. But what I mean by that is a premature maturing as we kind of grow and develop from the inside and have this confidence that our for example, our self-preoccupations, the ways that we were shy or the ways in which we are embarrassed by ourselves or trying to protect ourselves or trying to present a certain image of ourselves to others, and which might have been useful when we were young, but at some point is no longer interesting. And, you know, I could probably tell you the story of my life from the point of view of my hair and all the different hairstyles I've had over my lifetime, and how it represented different ways that I wanted to be seen or different ways that I saw myself and different some things, you know, but, you know, some value, something or other. And at some point, I can confidently say, for the most part, I kind of don't really care so much about my hair anymore. It's not really as center stage as it was when I was probably 13 or so, and I would sit in class and I'd be pulling my hair to try to get it to grow longer, faster. And it was rather an embarrassment to come back to California from Europe in 1967 and be a guy with hair that wasn't quite long enough because, you know, it was supposed to be long hair then. And so I would sit in class and thinking that somehow if I pulled it, tugged on it, it would get longer. So anyway, so there's all these things that we kind of see. That, and so Dharma practice is also about this, a kind of healthy maturation. And some of that, what form it takes, is greater self-understanding about some of the deep inner beliefs that operate inside of us. That as we settle in and get quieter and more concentrated, more still in practice, it's not for the purpose of stillness only, but it's also the purpose to better see. And some of what we see is, in fact, some of the beliefs we carry with us. And for me, there were subtle attitudes, beliefs that I carried with me, that the fact that they were so subtle I couldn't see them did not mean that they were unimportant. They were like the perfume that kind of wafted into everything I did. And in terms of meditation, one of these that if I was sitting in a meditation hall with other people, which I did a lot when I was younger, I had this, it took a long time to see that I had this belief. It was more like a burden, or almost more like a tension that I carried with me. But the belief was that the grass was always better in the person sitting next to me in the meditation hall. They were always better than me. They were always more concentrated, more free, more calm. They were just always better than me. And that was just an underlying, very subtle, quiet, unseen belief. But it created kind of a wall. It created a tension in that direction. It created a kind of feeling that I'm inadequate, that I'm somehow not right in some way. And it was more experienced as kind of very subtle feeling of, I'm not right. But why am I not right? It never occurred to me to question it or wonder why I was feeling this way. I guess it just was, you know, and I'm not quite right. And then when I saw, I'm always kind of oriented towards others, and they are always kind of assuming. I didn't even know, I mean, a clue what goes on in their minds and what their meditation was like. And when I saw that and was able to drop it, or it fell away because I saw it, it got easier. Another subtle one that I had in terms of meditation was the idea that if it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. I didn't know what the real thing is, but I just knew the policy. It was just a policy, right? So it just applied freely to everything. And so if it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. So if there was supposed to be some concentration in the practice, if I got concentrated, well, it wasn't the real thing. If you're supposed to have a spacious, open mind, if I had a spacious, open mind, well, it wasn't quite the real thing. It didn't really count because it was mine. And so you can fill in the rest. You know, just all the, no matter what I did, whatever I experienced, whatever happened in meditation, it was never good enough. It wasn't the real thing. That was, again, such a subtle belief that I didn't see it. I just knew something was off and that I was not really doing it right, was the feeling. But I didn't know what right was. I didn't know enough to question it in those early years. Until one day I started to say, I wonder, is that what I'm believing? Is this really? Is that what's happening? And then I started to say, oh, in fact, yes, there was this very quiet but persistent idea that prevented me from ever feeling that what I was doing was right, in a sense, or appropriate. And mostly what I learned to do then was to let it go, that belief. And I let it go in such a way that I kind of had the wisdom at some point, I didn't have to be the right. It didn't have to be wrong. It just had to be my experience in meditation. And I could just find my way with my experience and go forward from there. It didn't have to be right or wrong. And this idea of looking for right and wrong was, again, wasn't really needed for the purposes of being present. And all these things, these realizations and stuff, and doing the practice, I got this more and more this confidence that kind of allowed me to see those things, allowed me to see, as I had more ease, how I lost that ease and the beliefs that caused me to lose that ease. And so sometimes it's helpful in practice to consider what are the subtle beliefs that are operating. And it might take a while, but even to ask to discover what they are, but even to ask that question begins to open that door. Do I believe that there's always danger? No matter where I go, whatever is happening, I always have to be alert because it's dangerous. Do I always believe very subtly that I deserve something and it should be a lot easier meditation? I've known people who kind of felt that they just deserve to have good meditation because they meditated a lot. And it was kind of like magic thinking that if they meditate, they sat on a cushion long enough, they would be rewarded. But simply just sitting on the cushion and doing nothing else, I think it was Ajahn Sumedho who says, if sitting was where it's at, chickens would be enlightened. There's more than just sitting is needed. There has to be some engagement. There's also, you know, subtle attitudes that, you know, we know about people who will very readily blame others or blame the world. And that can be a very subtle, unknown little policy that if it's not going well, something out there is to blame. Something is wrong. There's too much light in the meditation hall. There's not enough light in the meditation hall. There's too many people making noise. It's because I chose the wrong pants to wear to meditate in. It's those pants. And it goes on. You know, something out there is at fault. So I could go on, but, you know, maybe none of the things I'm talking about relate to any particular ones of you, but what I'm trying to do is give you the idea of, you know, to look at yourself this way. But then not to get too, take it too seriously either. Don't feel like it's a personal failing to have these things. And don't feel like you have to now go get the next self-help book to kind of work through it. Maybe there's a way in which you can embody confidence in the practice. You can embody just engaging forward, keeping the boat plowing ahead through the water and not stopping for anything. And as you get stronger and more capable and more kind of cruising in the present moment, staying in the present, you might find that things fall away or things start feeling like just little flies that are flying around who are not really bothering you, and you don't have to pick them up and get involved. And maybe you don't have to see anything as a personal fault. It's just personal flies. Wouldn't that be nice? And sometimes we have a lot of flies, and sometimes there's few flies, and it's just little flies, and you're becoming an elephant, and elephants don't care too much about the flies around them. You're becoming big. So how would you like to live your life, as an ant or a fly? And the way you go from being an ant to a fly is you just start being present for what you are. And if you're an ant, great. Start recognizing it, being it, seeing it clearly, and start exercising the muscle of mindfulness, the muscle of ease, the muscle of care and compassion, the muscle of dedication and continuity and practice. You keep doing it, and it's remarkable how you'll grow and develop. And things that don't have, things will kind of recede or fall away on their own to a great degree, this practice. So the last thing I'll say about cultivating confidence and self-confidence is that often it's cultivated in a lot of small steps. And small steps where maybe you stretch yourself a little bit. You go in a little bit in place where you don't have confidence, but it's not a big thing to go do it. Just a little bit. And an accumulation of a lot of small steps and going into a little bit against your edge in practice and keep doing it and keep doing it, it all builds. And it builds a lot faster than we usually predict. And so I'll end with this story that it was instruction that I received or heard. I don't know if I received it directly, but I heard from a yoga teacher. This is back in the days when there were telephone books. And if some of you remember the big fat telephone books that had very, very thin paper, each page. And so the instruction was, if you can't do the triangle pose in yoga, so it means you can't get one hand down to the ground when you bend over in a particular way, sideways way, that you get a stack of these telephone books until the telephone books can receive your hand. You can lean over and touch the telephone book. And then every day you keep doing it, you tear out one page. Like from one day to the next, it's so thin, it's insignificant for sure. But if you do it every day, then over time, eventually your hand reaches the floor in such small increments you don't see it. But after a year or 2 years or 3 years, depending how many pages you needed to have there, lo and behold, you've touched the floor. So with Dharma practice, don't underestimate how much you can do in these small steps of always just a little bit pushing yourself or going up against your edge or doing a little bit more of the practice or doing a little bit more concentration work or something, just whatever it is that it feels like really it's a muscle you want to develop. And that can be true for many things outside of meditation. Buddhism emphasizes cultivating generosity, cultivating kindness, cultivating patience, cultivating equanimity, cultivating ethical integrity. All these things, to cultivate them with these small incremental steps and develop confidence in this over time and confidence that you can grow makes the practice so much easier. And if it takes you 3 years to pull all the pages out of the telephone book, to look from today forward into 3 years, That's way too long. Who would spend that much time doing it? 3 years from now, if you look back 3 years, it'll seem like it went really fast. Don't regret your 3 years because it seems so long. It's not so long. So, thank you. So now we have, we're coming into the closing of the retreat, and we'll come back at the regular time at 2:30, and then we will at 2, and then at 2:30 there'll be the talks. That's what the schedule is. I'm reminding myself here, looking. So I should know it, and I moved the schedule from where I'm sitting. So anyway, the schedule has changed, and if you could please look at it, then I'll look at it too. But the Dharma talks at 2:30, and then we'll have a closing circle. Yeah, the sitting's at 2 p.m., and then I'll follow that with a talk, and then we'll take a break for half an hour. There'll be some announcements at various times, and then we'll do a closing circle that's kind of the similar to the opening circle we had at the beginning of the day, with the aim to finish around 5 o'clock, California time. So enjoy your next couple of hours, and those of you having lunch, please enjoy your lunch, and you have this next break time for a couple of more hours of a contemplative life. May you enjoy it. Thank you.